Thanks to Netflix Instant Streaming for supporting this episode of the Paranormal Podcast. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, Android, iPad, iPhone, iPod Touch, or TV instantly. All streamed to you by Netflix, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/Jim. That's Netflix.com/Jim. Thanks, Netflix.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold. So glad to be with you today. And this really is a pleasure. I've actually got somebody on the line that I haven't spoken to in about 20 years. But if you like what it is that we do here, other than my family and other than me, he's probably the person most responsible for it. I'm talking about Dr. Robert Jacobs. He was my mentor when I was in college. He was a professor and showed me and many other people in the industry the way. And he had always, his voice had been in the back of my ear, do this broadcasting thing, even though he didn't know it. I just shared that story with him. And today we're going to talk about a new book that Bob has out. It's called Season of the Beast. It's a fiction book. It's terrifying. I just finished reading it. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm going to enjoy introducing Bob to you today. Now, Bob started in television film while still in college at USC. As a student, he worked at Disney Studios on the True Life Adventure television series hosted by Walt Disney himself. He went on to work at the major studios, including Warner Brothers, Paramount, MGM, and as a contract player for 20th Century Fox, where he had a speaking role in South Pacific. Next, he became a motion picture officer in the U.S. Air Force for 5.5 years. After service, Bob worked as a writer, director, cameraman, and editor on a number of films, TV programs, and commercials. His writing and credits include Beethoven, Bach, and Beatles, the Simon and Garfunkel special, and the Midnight special, which he co-created. Pretty neat story. He has also produced 3 full-length feature films and directed 2 of them, The Fry Cook and Exit Dying. He has written dozens of magazine and newspaper articles and stories, 2 trade books about TV producing, and 1 published novel. In Northern California, he was a disc jockey, late-night talk show host, and then a program director and sales manager at 2 FM stations, and was eventually bitten by the academic bug. And he went on to get his PhD and become a college professor, and here he is today, teaching at Bradley University while still active in professional film and television work. He produces, shoots, hosts, and edits a biweekly series called Postcards from Home, airing on WEEK in Peoria, Illinois. He has 7 nominations and 1 Emmy and a collection of over 20 other national and international awards for his work, both with the series and for the numerous long-form documentaries he has produced over the past 20 years. Bob Jacobs, welcome to the program. We're going to talk about Season of the Beast.
Yeah, I'd like to hire this guy.
I got to tell you, this is a very impressive resume, and I really wanted to read the whole thing because that's one of the things when you were a professor and I was a lowly student. That's one thing I thought was really cool is this is a guy that's been.
You were never a lowly student. You were an outstanding guy from the time I first met you. You were never a lowly student.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that. But really, the thing that I loved about your classes is that you had the academic background, you could write research papers and do all of that stuff, but you really had a ton of real world experience, which you a lot of times don't see in academia.
That's correct. Most academics, and I say this from a long experience with academics, have done nothing but go to school to learn from people who did nothing but go to school, who learned from people who did nothing but go to school. It's very seldom that you find people in the academic situation today, which I think is partly what's wrong with higher education in America, that people in the professions don't come back into teaching and share what they know about the real world, about how business operates, about how production operates, about how creative things operate in the real world, where they have to make a living and so forth. I think that's something missing in academic circles.
Now, before we got started, you told me a really interesting story. I'm looking here at Season of the Beast. It is a novel, and it's a gripping piece of fiction. I'll just say this. I know that you were very close for many decades with the late, great Ray Bradbury. And on the back of the dust cover here, it says, "The characters are well drawn and the atmosphere works and chills one. You scared me a couple of times. Bravo." Can you tell us kind of condensed history of this book? Because it really kind of talks about the power of perseverance.
Sure. When I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin at Oshkosh, which is where the novel is set, I got a bug because Ray, who was my honorary godfather, kept bugging me. He kept saying, "Bob, write a novel. Get writing. Write me just 5 pages a day, and at the end of 6 or 7 months, you'll have a novel." I went, "I can't write a novel." And then one night, literally at night, about 11 o'clock, I was sitting in my house, bored with TV, and I said, "I think I'll go back to my office." I went back over to my office, which is across the street from where I lived in Oshkosh. I went up to the office, sat down on my typewriter. We had typewriters in those days. That's how long ago it was. My IBM Corrections electric typewriter, that's what I wrote on. I turned on the light in my office and sat down and said, "Now, what do I want to do here?" And Ray always said this. He said, "If you want to write, sit down at your keyboard, put your hands on it, and start pressing keys, and something will come out." So I did exactly that. I just started. I started, I'll do this and that and that. And finally what came out was, I live near Lake Butamore, which means Lake of the Dead or Bluff of the Dead. And I thought, well, let me think about that lake for a while. And suddenly this horrible monster emerged up out of the depths of the muck and the goo, eons old, and turned its attention toward Oshkosh, toward the lights of the city. And I went, "Oh, God, that's scary." So that came out. And, Jim, it was like watching a movie. I sat there for 2.5 weeks, every night from 11 o'clock till 1 in the morning, and just made my fingers move on the keyboard, and characters came to life based on people I knew. And at the end of 2.5 weeks, I had a 400-page novel. I was so proud of myself. 400 pages, this is better than Stephen King. Well, of course, 400-page first novel is just nonsense, but I loved every word. So I sent it off to Ray. He sent me back a letter saying, "Cut, cut, cut. When you're finished cutting, send it back to me." So I was mad and upset. I thought, what the heck does Ray Bradbury know about writing? So I started cutting. At the end of it, I had about 280 pages, and I sent those back to him, and he wrote back a glowing letter to me saying, "By God, son, you do know how to write. This is beautiful. I think this one can sell." After I crawled up off the floor and started crying, I thought, my God, he likes it. So he said a few things to me about fixing it up. I needed to take a few of the F-bombs out of it and tidy up a character or two. When I did that, I sent it back to him, and he said, "This is it. Send it out." And he gave me the address of a Judy Lynn Del Rey at Ballantine Books. He said, "Send it off to Judy Lynn Del Rey. I'm going to call her and tell her it's coming. I think you've done it." So I sent it off to Judy Lynn Del Rey, and I never heard from her. And ever. So I got fairly discouraged with that. I told Ray, and he said, "Oh, to hell with her." He said, "Send it out to, and he gave me another name. So I sent it out to that person. At the end of the year, this was now into toward the end of 1980, I had sent it out to 4 or 5 places and got no response, just ignored. So I gave up. I threw the novel in the drawer, literally, just tossed it in the drawer and left it there, and went on with my writing career, doing television scripts and short stories and articles for magazines and so on and so forth, and, of course, teaching college. About 10 years ago, I got a call from a guy named Ron Alcorn in Pasadena, maybe 15 years ago, who said, "Hey, I need a writer to write finish a script for me, so can you come out and do that?" And I said, "Sure." So I went out to Pasadena, and he put me up in his office, and I wrote a novel for young adults, and that was based on a script from somebody else, and I wrote a script adapted from a novel by Barry Sadler called Nashville with a Bullet.
Oh, yeah, Green Berets, Battles of the Green Berets.
Yeah, I am. And I did that, and I made $5,000 or $10,000 for the summer. And he said, "Did you write a novel once?" And I said, "Yeah, I did." So he said, "Let me see that." So I let him see it. He said, "Wow, Bob, this is great." Every time somebody says, "Bob, this is great," I go, "Well, that's a bomb. It's not going anywhere." So I gave it to him. He sent it off to Pinnacle Books. I'm not even sure whether they still publish or not, but it was a pretty good paperback company. And I got a report back from the slush reader at Pinnacle saying, this is a great book for a first novel, and Ray Bradbury likes it, and I think we should publish it. Never heard from Pinnacle Books. So I put it back in the drawer. Last year, 2012, I got a call from an old friend of mine that I had known in the Air Force, Dennis Pfister by name. He said, hey, Bob, I've got a friend out here named Karen Veeley who's starting an e-book publishing company, and didn't you write a novel once? I said, yeah. He said, well, why don't you send it out to her? So I hauled it out of the drawer, and I updated the references in it, rewrote it a bit, and I sent it out to her. 3 weeks later, she called back and said, Bob, I love it. We're going to publish it. So 33 years after I wrote it, I'm a published novelist.
Overnight success, huh?
Overnight success, yes. I'm so proud of myself.
No, but you should be, and that does show the power of perseverance. As people who listen to this program know, it took me some years to get to my appointed station in life, but you eventually get there, and you've done so many things. Now, one thing that we have to do is take this short break, and we'll get back to talking about Season of the Beast with Bob Jacobs. This episode of the Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, iPod Touch, Android, or TV instantly. All streamed to you by Netflix, saving you time, money, and hassle. Now, there are a ton of ways to access Netflix on your TV. There's PS3, Wii, Xbox, Roku, internet-connected smart TVs, and also virtually all your Android devices, your iOS devices, you all can get apps. Windows Phone, you can get an app. It's very, very cool, I've got to tell you. It really is one of the best entertainment values around. And for you, it's even a better value. It's free for a 30-day trial if you go over and sign up at netflix.com/Jim. That's netflix.com/Jim. Now, we've said before, if you're a fan of sci-fi, it's a fantastic place. Star Trek, Twilight Zone, Supernatural, Walking Dead, The X-Files, Warehouse 13, Buffy, Charmed, Battlestar Galactica. And then also, if you like cutting-edge new shows, original shows, you've got House of Cards. There's a new one out called Orange is the New Black, about a young woman who unfortunately finds herself in prison. Hemlock Grove, we've talked about. And of course, the revival of Arrested Development. And you can watch all of these shows, plus all the thousands of other TV series and great movies on Netflix. And you can do it with your free 30-day trial. You just go over to netflix.com/Jim. That's netflix.com/Jim to sign up. I use them. I pay for it every month, and gladly so, because really there is no better entertainment value. We thank Netflix for their support, and we hope you enjoy Netflix Instant Streaming. Thanks, Netflix.
Be sure to follow Jim on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. Find all the links at jimherald.com. Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Bob Jacobs. We're talking about his book, Season of the Beast. You mentioned this earlier, but let's go into it a little deeper. I noticed some characters there who reminded me a little bit of Bob Jacobs, who maybe reminded me of some other people that you probably worked with. Tell us about how you incorporate real people, including yourself, but still being true to doing something new and fresh.
I don't think any writer can concoct somebody out of thin air. I think what writers do, at least what I do as a writer, is I observe. I look at people, I see what that guy's doing, I see what this woman is doing. If I go to a cafe, I sit and look at people, try to guess what they're thinking, what they're up to, why they're dressed that way, and so on. Obviously, my close friends are going to appear in my novels because they're the people I know best. I know, for example, if I'm developing a character, I have to decide, well, let's see, what's this character look like? Tall, thin, fat, skinny, short-haired, long-haired, dark hair, all of those physical attributes. Then I go, how is this character going to dress, and how is the dress of the character going to inform the reader about what the character thinks of himself or herself? Then I have to decide what the person says, how they sound. For example, if I write a character and talk like this, I'll bet you know where he's from in the United States of America, wouldn't you?
Yeah, sure.
So I have to write a dialect. I try not to write broad dialects, but you have to sort of make your character sound like somebody. In my book, for example, there's a detective in the Oshkosh Police Force named Pishke, Detective Pishke. And by God, he sounded like this. He went on by praying. He smoked.
And the funny thing is, I knew that by reading the book. I mean, that's the accent that I assigned to it. So it obviously worked.
Well, good. So anyhow, these are the things that I put together. Now, obviously, all the characters I write are fictionalized. For example, my friend, the late Jay Walsh, on whom the character Red in my book is based, was certainly not an evil guy possessed by a demon. He was a very sweet, lovable guy, but he looked and he sounded and he acted like the character Red in the book. So I'm sure that he's looking down from heaven and saying, "Way to go, Bob, at least I'm in a book." So I think that we have to look at people and make pastiches, make combinations of people to be characters in our book, because I can't create somebody. Only God can create somebody, certainly not me.
Now, in your book, there's some really frightening passages. Obviously, that's by design. What scares you, and what do you think scares most readers out there?
I believe passionately that evil exists. It's a real, tangible thing. I think good exists. I think it's a real, tangible thing. And I don't want to put it in terms of God and the devil, but evil is real. And you can prove it by looking around. Can I say bastard on your show?
Absolutely.
Some bastard straps a bunch of dynamite to himself, gets on a school bus in Israel, and blows up school kids. That's evil. That's unmitigated evil. That has nothing to do with Islam or going to heaven or being serviced by 22 virgins. That's just evil. So, since we know that evil exists in the world, as some twisted moron goes into a schoolhouse in Connecticut and blows away children and so on, since we know evil exists, we have to confront it. We've confronted it for forever as human beings by fictionalizing it. Hansel and Gretel is about evil, isn't it? That evil witch who wants to cook them and eat them. These are all metaphors, of course, for things in our life that we have to confront. I love horror movies, for example, good ones. We confront, for example, Dracula. We go to see Dracula, and there's that evil, horrible, blood-sucking thing, undead thing that comes in the night and sucks the blood out of young women and so on, which is a metaphor for certain social things. Anyhow, at the end of the day, at the end of the movie, at the end of the book, at the end of something, we're confronting death, which is Dracula, which is the Frankenstein monster, which is Freddy Krueger death, that skeleton that lives inside of us, that horrible symbol of death, which is right inside of us. We confront that, and then at the end of the movie or the end of the book, we have to kill it. We have to stab the vampire in the heart with a stake, and we have to burn Frankenstein, and we have to get rid of that evil so that we can get through the night and go, "Oh, I'm not going to die, at least tonight." And I think that's why I write horror. I love to scare you and then let you off at the end. I hope I let you off at the end of this book somehow.
Now, something that I also think is interesting, and a lot of writers do this, I think you certainly did it in this book, you take a bucolic, kind of placid setting. I've never been to Oshkosh, but by reading your book and everything I've heard, it's a pretty placid place, pretty peaceful place. And you juxtapose that with some great evil, and that kind of ratchets up the tension. Can you talk about that a little bit? And I'm assuming that was by design.
It is by design. Look, we can scare ourselves easily on the subway in New York, can't we? I mean, it's just scary to be down there. So as far as I'm concerned, unless I'm writing for CSI or one of those TV dramas, I stay away from that. It's much more exciting for me and fun for me to take you out to, for example, in my next book, which is called The Curse of Grinder's Ferry. We're going down to the bucolic setting of the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas by the banks of the beautiful Buffalo National River, where this antique ferry place suddenly starts producing bodies that float down river and come up and I don't want to give much more away than that, but I love bucolic settings because I live in them. I hate cities. I just came back. My wife and I were in the UK for 2 weeks and went to London and got out of there as quickly as possible to go see the rest of England. And we spent 3 days in the Cotswolds and went all the way and stayed in the country as much as possible. I think you know that I didn't like Cleveland very much. No offense.
Yes, I recall that.
But big cities scare me because they remind me of the psychological experiment with a frog. If you put a frog in a terrarium, a nice placid place with some water in it, and put a Bunsen burner under it and raise the temperature of that water 1 degree a day, at the end of 212 days, the water will boil and the frog will die, and it will never have known that the temperature was going up. And I think that's true of the psychic temperature in cities. That's why people go crazy. I think cities are insane asylums. No one should live in a place like New York City or London. I guess Cleveland is a little better because it's not quite as big, but I live 45 miles from the nearest town. I have a farm out here that's surrounded right now by corn on one side and soybeans on the other and some alfalfa that I'm growing. And I can ride my motorcycle from here into the university on the back roads and never see a car until I get into downtown Peoria. My cabin in the Ozarks is on 25 acres of beautiful, pristine forest where elk come up and graze and bear come up out of the hollows, and I love it. And I think that because very few people get to experience this, very few people get to experience a bucolic little town like Oshkosh. By showing you this other side of the world that you live in, I can take you out of your city and put you in a place where you think you should feel secure and wonderful and warm, and all of a sudden, bam, I slap you in the face because evil's out here too.
It is everywhere.
Evil's everywhere. And we have to be on guard against it.
Agreed. Now, one thing you talk about, and I don't want to give away too much of the story, but a couple of things that play a big part are fear and anxiety. Can you talk about the anxiety of society and I guess the psychic drain? Because I'm guessing that you were shooting for maybe some kind of you're trying to draw some parallel that fear and anxiety can undo us, much like it kind of played into the monster of this book.
Well, the monster in my book is simply the embodiment of evil. I mean, that thing that we can't quite point a finger at. In fact, I never describe the monster from the lake in the book. I just let you draw those images for yourself because we all know what that's like. We go to bed at night, and we're having a sleepless night. I'm sure you've had them. And the lights are out, and it's dark, and you kind of start thinking, God, I'm alive, but will I be alive tomorrow? What about the mortgage? What about the... And we start conjuring all these horrible images of what could go wrong before the light comes up and we wake up and have a cup of coffee and go, oh, I guess it's going to be all right. And I think it's my job as a writer, especially loving to write horror stories, that I have to tell you that it's going to be all right. I think that, for example, the nightly news lies to us. We are so anxious about the nightly news because it talks about who got shot that day, who got run over by a car that day, what awful political entity is rising in the east and threatening to kill us all. And we live with that kind of anxiety and that terrible, inexplicable, indefinable thing that's going to come and get us. And, you know, 98% of us are good, God-fearing people who get up and go to work and do our jobs and love our spouses and our children and take care of things. And only 1 or 2% are talk to us about in the nightly news. I know that because my wife is the managing news editor at the NBC affiliate in Peoria. And I know when she comes home filled with awful things that happened today, I say, yeah, but what population of our community was that who did that awful thing? Well, there was that one guy who shot somebody. I said, we live in an area of over 1 million people, and one guy shot somebody, and that means that it's a horrible life. So
right.
I think that my job as a writer is to say, come on, guys, it's not all horrible. It's a gift from God, and we're supposed to enjoy it. We're going to be all right. And let me scare you just a little bit. So when you wake up in the morning, you can discover that, oh, that was just a book. It was just some crazy guy out in the wilds of Illinois wrote in his farmhouse.
One thing
why
I'm...
Why do we like stories like Grimm and not CSI, because both those programs are too, how can I put it, desensitizing.
Yeah, but maybe Once Upon a Time is another example.
Once Upon a Time is a great TV series. I love it. But CSI has done things to us that are awful, because I can't scare you anymore by describing a mutilated body, can I? Because we've seen that over and over again on CSI, and say, oh, let's pull that eyeball out and look at it. So what I have to do now as a writer who wants to give you a good scare is put the terror back in your own mind. I'm not going to describe things to you where I say, and he took up the knife and he cut her this way. I'm going to suggest things to you that you'll read it and go, ooh, what if he, and then your own mind will go, oh, gosh, and you'll flip the page and something will happen, hopefully.
One thing I thought was really interesting in your book, and I find it even more interesting seeing when you wrote this book in 1979, you talk about academia. And sometimes, particularly when you're a young college student, you think of professors as these perfect people who are there to institute learning and not as real humans with foibles. They go to the bathroom, they have sex, they lust, they play politics. And I thought that was really interesting in the book, that you drew these professors not as some kind of people in an ivory tower, but as real humans who are imperfect like all of us.
Exactly. I think that's important for people to understand. We look up to somebody because he has doctor so-and-so. Well, I've got a PhD, which just goes to show that anybody can get a PhD. Because I'm just good old exurbanated homespun Bob to myself and to my students. I think it's important for us to remember that politicians, for example, Barack Obama is a guy. He's a guy with a background and a guy with a couple of good-looking daughters and a wife and some political ambition. But he's not God. He's not the savior of the world. He's just a politician. And I think it's important for us to know that, to realize that, to understand that at a deep level. We put people up on pedestals and nearly worship them, because we don't have royalty in this country like they do in Britain, where I've just come from. So we have to put somebody up, and frequently it's some stupid-ass celebrity. Who gives a flip about Britney Spears?
Or the Kardashians, which are my personal peeve.
Exactly. What have the Kardashians ever done except have sex on
They're
on,
famous
on
for being TV? Famous.
Exactly. It's insane. And they make millions of dollars. And elementary school teachers who make 20 grand a year, who teach our children up, down, back, forward, red, black, yellow, white, all the colors, and 1, 2, 3, 4, they make 20,000 bucks a year. We've got things wrong in this country in terms of what people are worth. And celebrity is one of those things that I rail against. I was a local celebrity here. I have been for some 22 years, where I do this little show called Postcards from Home. And it's just silliness. People worship the guy who reads the news at night. He walks out, and we go out to have coffee, and I'm with the nightly anchor. And people go, oh, hi, look, so-and-so, can I have your autograph? He's just the guy who reads the news, that's all. He's just a guy who works for a living.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had a little taste of that, not locally, because nobody locally knows who I am. but among people who listen to this show, and God bless you all, and I'm very appreciative, but sometimes I got somebody to say that, email me saying I was an icon. And first of all, no offense, but that's laughable. but my wife, to keep me in check, said, hey, it's time for the icon to go out and cut the grass. So... So point being, thank you very much for the kind compliments, but we all are just people. And, yep. the mightiest of us someday will be 6 feet under, just like everybody else. We're all mortals and subject to those same foibles. So I thought that was an interesting treatment. So, I've got to ask you this. It's interesting to me. You've done so much on the academic side, and you've been in Hollywood with the big boys, but having a book that sat in a drawer for over 30 years and then having that published, did that throw you for a loop? Did it give you maybe a new perspective, or how did it make you feel?
Well, first of all, it made me feel unreal. I've loved the book since I first wrote. I loved the 400-page version. I loved the 300-page version. I like the 240-page version, which is out there in at Ballot Press right now. I have to plug. You can buy the book at ballotpress.com or amazon.com, backslash books, type in Season of the Beast. There, that's my plug. I've loved the book all along, and so I couldn't understand why nobody ever responded to it. Ray, all of his life, bless his heart, said, "Pop, that's a great book. Why isn't somebody picking it up? Why isn't it being published?" I said, "You got me, Pop. I don't know." So he did say one thing that meant something to me. He said, "If you keep sending something out, you might even send it back to the same publishing house 10 years later, and there'll be a new editor there. And maybe the new editor likes it, and the other editor didn't like it." Because, I mean, works of art, and I can call this art because I think writing is an art, is highly subjective, isn't it? I mean, you either like it or you don't like it.
Right.
And editors, being humans like the rest of us, read it and go, "I don't like that." And that's the end of your chance at that editing, at that publishing house. So I think if folks out there in your audience are interested in writing, keep writing. And do what Ray said. Write 5 pages a day. Hey, I'll tell you what, write 1 page a day. Just sit down and write 1 page a day. At the end of a year, you've got a 300-page novel.
That's true. And the thing is that it has to be special to you, seeing that Ray Bradbury passed a little over a year ago. It's got to be special to you, I think, in some way, that this book is actually out now. I would think in some ways it's almost like a tip of the cap to him that it actually did see the light of day, and his faith in it was correct. It was just took a little while.
Yeah. It's dedicated to him and to my wonderful wife, Max, without whom I couldn't exist. And my only sadness is that he didn't live to see it get published. I think he would have been so proud.
And I've got to say, it really is a scary book. I mean, again, I'm biased because I'm a big fan of Bob. And again, we've not, this may be the first time we've spoken in 20 years. I'm not sure, but but nevertheless, I've been a huge fan. You've meant so much in my life. I do want to ask you one more question before we go, and then I want you to recap where people can get the book.
Sure.
You write in many different media, film, TV, books. What do you find different about writing for the written page, and what excites you about it as maybe opposed to some other types of writing?
Well, I've been doing television for so long, writing television scripts, that I can literally write them. Just get out of bed, get to the keyboard, and go blah, blah, blah. Because most television is, of course, visual. And you've got to be very careful writing for TV that you don't overwrite. The dialogue has to be sparse, concise, to the point, and keep the plot moving. I love the novel form because I get to describe things. Ray Bradbury's books, for example, never translated very well to film. Because what you love about Ray Bradbury's books is Ray Bradbury's writing. He's a poet. When he describes the grandfather mowing the grass in Dandelion Wine, you can smell the grass. You can hear the turning of that push mower. You can smell Grandpa's sweat because Ray describes that for you. And that's what I like about writing novels. I'm writing a book right now. In fact, it's in front of me at my computer screen right now, called Ray and Me, My 50-Year Love Affair with Ray Bradbury. It's my publisher, Karen Veeley, said, "You've got how many letters from Ray?" I said, "Oh, 400, I don't know, over 50 years, a lot of letters." She said, "Why don't you put those in a book?" And I said, I don't think that would be appropriate. She said, well, think about it. So my wife and I, Ray also loved my wife very dearly. We sat down and went through the letters one night, and we kind of categorized them and put them in decades. And at the end of it, I thought, gosh, this might be Ray's legacy to me, that this relationship about a man who took a kid from Compton, California, me, when I was 18, and said, "Hey, why don't you be my honorary son?" And I went, got nothing better to do. So he took me under his wing. He showed me, he taught me things that I didn't know before. Coming from Compton, California, for example, I didn't know it was all right to write poetry. I didn't know it was all right to cry when you're upset. I thought you've got to be a man and stand up. And Ray taught me, bullshit, pardon me.
That's fine.
He said, it's all right to cry. We're supposed to cry. Well, we have a feminine side and a masculine side, and why don't you just explore that? And so I did. I went into acting. I wrote poetry and got some of it published while I was still in high school. I learned how to sing, and I learned how to love myself. My father was not a very good father. He was one of those tough guys from South Dakota who couldn't care less about love and poetry and so on, and warned me that when I went into theater, he said, if you go down the primrose path, I'll kill you. And I went, what the hell's a primrose path? I had no idea what he was talking about. I mean, that's how hidebound he was. I'm assuming he meant homosexuality, which, who cares? And God bless the new law saying it's okay to get married. I think anybody who wants to get married and should get married, period, the end. That's my thought on that, just in case you want to know.
Well, we love talking.
Anyhow,
with
you. What I was going to finish with is that I love writing the novel form because I get to describe things and I get to play with things and I get to scare myself. When I sit down on my typewriter, or my keyboard now, I turn on, it's like a magic screen in my head, and I'm seeing characters come to life, and they pop up and start doing things, and I'm just sitting here writing what I see.
That's something that amazed. I've dabbled with some fiction writing, although I've not released it. My only book is nonfiction based on my campfire show. And it's funny, even in a little bit that I've done, how characters kind of take off and do their own thing. And it's kind of like, well, where did that come from?
Yeah, I think
there's
this constant flow of creative forces floating around the universe, and occasionally those of us who have a kind of a warp in our brain will let it in, and we go, oh, that's exciting. I think maybe that's what's called creativity. I argue with my academic colleagues that you can't teach creativity. People are either creative or they're not. You can't teach them how to be creative. You can inspire them and encourage them, but you can't teach them.
Makes sense to me. Bob Jacobs, where can people, again, find the book? How can they get Season of the Beast? And I do recommend it, so please pick it up. We'll also have a link at jimherold.com, but where can they go to pick that up?
It's available in ebook, Kindle, or in paperback from ballotpress.com, www.ballotpress, ballotpress.com. That's the publisher. It's also available at Amazon.com/books, type in Season of the Beast. Just one season, one beast.
Very good.
If anybody buys, by the way, if you read it, I'd sure appreciate it if you'd send in a review, because I always like to know how people respond to my work.
Excellent. Well, Bob Jacobs, thank you for taking time today to be on the Paranormal Podcast.
My pleasure, Jim. Thanks a lot.
And thank you for tuning in to the Paranormal Podcast. We certainly appreciate it. And much like Bob, we appreciate it when you rate our work. And one of the ways, and the main way people find us, is over at iTunes. So if you listen via iTunes, please go in, leave us a review, an honest review and rating, and also put in that 2 or 3 sentence blurb that helps us greatly and gets us up the charts. And it only takes 3 or 4 minutes, and it helps us tremendously. We thank you so much for tuning in. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye, everybody. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.